Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, for our weekly roundup of the news that matters. With us, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large at CQ Roll Call and occasional visitor to the White House, John T. Bennett. This week, we're going to unwrap Time's Person of the Year, Trump's call to be a dictator, of course. University of Pennsylvania's president has resigned over anti-Semitic remarks that, well, she didn't make but didn't explain herself too well in Congress. Biden has made a statement about not running and then saying that 50 other Democrats could beat Donald Trump. There's a small sliver of voters that it's going to end up, and we've talked about this a lot, that will end up making the difference in the next election. And for those of you who don't know, it's been 43 years since John Lennon was murdered, and we'll talk all about that in your favorite Christmas rock songs when we come back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. And with me, as always, is John T. Bennett, editor-at-large at CQ Roll Call, and former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin. And we start out today talking about Time's Person of the Year. Now, the Person of the Year, that's an annual issue of Time that features, well, in the past, it's featured people like Charles Lindbergh, the Pope, the President of the United States 23 times, the President of the United States, including Franklin Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, George Bush, Ronald Reagan have all been named Person of the Year. And this isn't necessarily because they did good things. It's just the most outstanding newsmaker of the year. There's been six, the General Party of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, the General Secretary. We've had Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev, Yuri Andropov, Mikhail Gorbachev, Adolf Hitler was a Person of the Year. We've had popes, and now we have Taylor Swift. For the very first time, it looks like even Time Magazine's getting sick of politics, and one of the reasons they named Taylor Swift was because she was a storyteller of her time and inspired hope. Hope being, I guess, the thing that people want to see most of these days. So we'll start with you, Michael. Were you surprised by Taylor Swift being named the Person of the Year? Does it matter?
Well, it's always something to look forward to. It's like the Nobel Prizes and Most Valuable Player Awards. I always like to see who gets selected. Honestly, I hadn't thought of Taylor Swift as being a Person of the Year. Mm-hmm. I think I was reading after it that Elvis Presley, Michael Jackson, and Madonna, I think, are the only artists that were named Time Magazine Person.
Well, they were considered for it. I don't think this is the first time an actual entertainer was primary entertainer.
I see. So they didn't get it. They were just considered.
Yeah, nominated. Yeah.
For it. Uh-huh. As you said, it's nice to have, sort of end on an uplifting note, and surely her tour and the phenomenon that she is, sort of culturally and, obviously commercially, is fine with me. If you wanted to go on a darker side, you could say, Hamas or Vladimir Putin. I guess I'm fine. I'm just fine with ending on that upbeat note, because she really is a phenomenon. Maybe, in the category of Sinatra, Presley, Beatles. I mean, she...
None of them got it.
No, I understand. I understand. But you know what I'm saying is that this is a, you know, sort of a very unusual thing that she's accomplished here. So yeah, I'm fine with it.
As noted, she became the highest grossing concert tour of all time. Time describes Swift as the first person of the year to be recognized for their quote achievement in the arts, unquote. Swift is also part of the 2017 Person of the Year called the Silence Breakers. She was noted by the magazine as the first woman to be recognized more than once and the first woman to appear twice on a Person of the Year cover. John?
I heard this news and Homer Simpson popped into my head. There's a clip of Homer rather dismissively saying, "Hey, how about that?" And that was kind of my reaction. It's kind of a shrug. Oh, that's different. Hey, how about that? I mean, there's no doubting that the phenomenon that she is and the business person that she is and how successful she's been with her music. She touches a lot of people, and congratulations, Taylor.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Brian, when you and John, when you look at the short list of people, you've got the Hollywood Strikers. This is Time's short list as they revealed it. The finalists, Hollywood Strikers, the Chinese president, Taylor Swift, Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI, that, you know, the ChatGPT person, the Trump prosecutors, Barbie, Vladimir Putin, King Charles, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed, and that's their list. And so among that group there, you know, I'm good with with Taylor Swift.
Yeah. There's no clear cut, you know, there's no clear cut number one seed on that list. So
ever since Brian took himself out of the running. I mean, he did step out voluntarily. So that's something that your listening audience should be aware of.
That's well, him stepping down voluntarily just showed the bigness of spirit that is
Brian Caron. Exactly, he will not serve for that reason.
I have to say, I took myself out because after all, Ben Bernanke and Mark Zuckerberg were also, you know, at one point in time, Person of the Year. And I didn't know if I wanted to be in the same list as those two, but or Adolf Hitler. But the fact of the matter is, out of all those that were, I'll go with Taylor Swift over Mark Zuckerberg any day. But that's just me.
Or the Trump prosecutors. Or Barbie. Yeah.
Or Barbie. Yeah. I've got nothing against Barbie. Also this week, on a more serious note, University of Pennsylvania President Liz McGill and Board Chair Scott Bach resigned after a disastrous hearing on Capitol Hill about anti-Semitism. It's described in various publications as a stunning downfall for the leader of one of the world's most prestigious universities, and it happened because sitting in a hearing on Capitol Hill, McGill couldn't really quickly enough say that things that being done to Jewish students and people, that genocide was a bad thing, basically. She wasn't quick enough to condemn genocide. So I'd like you to unpack that a little bit, if you would, Michael, and we'll go from there.
Yes. So there was a hearing on the Hill and on anti-Semitism and First Amendment rights, and three university professors were being questioned by Stefanik, the Republican congresswoman from Staten Island, I think she is, a leadership member of the MAGA group that runs the Republican Party. And she was asking the three university presidents, Penn, MIT, and Harvard, is saying that genocide against the Jews is bullying. That was her question. Was it bullying? And each of these university professors should have said in answer the question, or I think it was bullying or intimidation or some exact, I forget the exact words, but it was bullying, maybe it was bullying or harassment was the way the question was phrased. And the way they chose to answer this was legalistically, which is to say, and we've talked about this before, that in order to incite or harass or bully by, you know, legal definitions, you've got to cross this Brandenburg line, which is it can't be just pure speech. I hate X group of people, but rather there's one of those X groups of people, person, let's get them. So when it transfers from speech to action is when it becomes a criminal actionable event. And so she was asking, is this bullying? If someone gets up a microphone and says, you know, death to the Jews, or I support the Klan, or some other odious thing, does that violate your policy? And they were focused on the legal answer, which is no, not technically, because it doesn't present an imminent threat of physical harm. And so no, not technically speaking. And it just was the worst possible answer. The possible answer of course that's terrible. Of course it's harassment and intimidation. Of course it violates the norms of society. But if you're asking me, technically speaking, as a legal matter, is it actionable? No, but you raise a good point, and maybe we should be looking at our policies more broadly to prevent hate speech on our closed campus. And so they kept saying, no, it's not technically so, or they equivocated. And ultimately, MIT wrote a note, the board sent a note supporting the president. I think Harvard isn't pretty silent about it. And in Penn, she was under a lot of pressure because there was a previous incident where I think there was some Palestinian organization that she gave the authority for them to meet on campus. What's telling is her resignation statement, Brian. She said, and I'll read it, I'll read a portion of it. It says, in that moment when I was being questioned, I was focused on our university's longstanding policies aligned with the U.S. Constitution, this Brandenburg line that I'm talking about. I was focused on our university's longstanding policies aligned with the United States Constitution, which say that speech alone is not punishable. That's what the First Amendment protects us against. I was focused on the university's longstanding policies aligned with the U.S. Constitution, which says that speech alone is not punishable. I was not focused on, but should have been, the irrefutable fact that a call for the genocide of the Jewish people is a call for some of the most terrible violence human beings can perpetrate. It's evil, plain and simple. In my view, it would be harassment and intimidation. This is what I should have said, she said, on reflection, but she's a First Amendment scholar. She is a free speech tenured professor in the law school, and she was being asked, is this essentially bullying? And she said, the lawyer in me was saying, well, no, not yet. And I didn't first say, it's terrible, full stop. We need to address it on our campus. But if you're asking me the technical legal question, no, it doesn't yet reach bullying because it's just speech and the Constitution prevents. So it was just a disaster. I don't know who prepped her for that testimony, but right. You know, shame on them, because it seemed an obvious question. But anyway, poor Professor McGill, or now Professor McGill, former President McGill at Penn, is no longer president. And, you know, I think it's the whole thing was a disaster. It was just as they say in law, a shit show.
Yeah, that's the technical term. That's in the same class you learn about writs and torts. John, yeah, exactly. John, your thoughts on it?
Yeah, this falls into the category of something I've been noticing. It's almost like nobody's reading the room anymore. And excuse me. And that goes into the prep, and who prepped these college presidents is a great question. You have to read the room, and you have to understand that you're in a political environment. And that's not the time to try to abide by some technical metric that's written down on a dusty book somewhere or posted a code of conduct or something. You have to understand who's asking you the question. You have to know who the members on the committee are. You have to do your homework. And it just didn't seem like any of them were ready for that hearing. But, you know, it was pretty obvious what the Republicans were going to use the hearing for and how they botched it. And Michael's right. It was a shit show and it was a disaster. And how did you walked in there and you weren't ready for those kinds of questions? It's really remarkable.
What I find fascinating is you touched it right there, John, is the lack of prep. And you mentioned it as well, Michael, but it's the appearance versus reality portion of the event. The reality was you weren't there to talk about the First Amendment. The reality was you wanted to talk about the appearance that this statement and what happened made. And look, I think it was the Yale School of Management professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld said it wasn't an issue of misspeaking. McGill and other university presidents missed the forest through the trees, upholding the right to free speech above the safety of students. Quote, university leaders have an elevated duty to fortify the truth and protect their campus communities from hate threats and violence, Sonnenfeld said in a statement. Freedom of expression is not an absolute right anywhere in society. Hate speech is different from speech. Yeah, I get that. I still think if you're talking technicalities, you're correct. I don't think it didn't breach that. But at the same time, you need to start out saying, look, we don't like this. This isn't any good. Damn it. We'll look into how we look at it in the future. And that would have been enough to satisfy, I think, even members of Congress, the appearance of it. Because at the end of the day, I understand her statements. I just think they were inappropriate for the where she was at that time.
Right. The thing that struck me, having been a law school teacher for a number of years, is that this was a as they say, a teachable moment. This was a moment where yes. The universities could say, hey, look, this went terribly and we are sorry for it. We're not going to take retributive action now, but rather what we're going to do is open up a full-throated dialogue around these issues. We are going to have symposium and speakers and presentations about free speech and the rights that people enjoy in our campus. We're going to have an open dialogue about this, and then that process will inform us whether or not we need to tinker with our policies. And if so, how? I mean, I think that they just react
knee-jerk
in a cover-your-ass sort of way. That's another legal phrase. I'm sorry to throw all this law stuff in here, shit show and cover-your-ass, but it's a cover-your-ass sort of thing. It's easy to say, we'll get rid of President McGill and, nothing more to see here. We've taken the action. Of course, that doesn't do anything except scapegoat her. And the university has got to address their lack of sort of spine or their lack of clarity around what does free speech on their campus entail. And that's, I think, a lost opportunity. They may still do that, but that's what I think it should have been their response, rather than we're throwing out the president and we're good now.
Scapegoat, exactly. Cover your ass. Man, you're covering all the legal terms this morning. When we come back, speaking of legal terms, when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit about, Donald Trump and his dictator comments, which Mitt Romney compared to a human gumball machine.
I'm Cyndi Lauper. My psoriasis was all over, even on my scalp, which may mean four times the risk for psoriatic arthritis. But Cosentyx works on both.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose and adults with active psoriatic arthritis 150 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for TB. Serious allergic reactions, severe skin reactions that look like eczema, and an increased risk of infections, some fatal, have occurred. Cosentyx may lower ability to fight infections, so tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if IBD symptoms develop or worsen. Learn more at Cosentyx.com or 1-844-COSENTYX. Ask your doctor about Cosentyx.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Crown. We'll talk about that human gumball machine when we get back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekend review, Just Ask the Press. As usual, John T. Bennett, editor-at-large at CQ Roll Call, and former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, who's been teaching us this morning those fine terms that you need to learn if you want to become a lawyer, such as covering your ass and shit show. So we're here to learn a little bit more. And John, I'm going to let you unpack this one. This week, Donald Trump said if he were reelected, he'd be a dictator, but just for one day. And he doubled down on that at an appearance later, but it was Mitt Romney, actually, who I loved his reaction to it. He said, and this is reported in one of your competitors, The Hill, President Trump's dictator remark, according to Mitt Romney, is nothing more than the output of a human gumball machine. Noting that neither is filtered before coming out. It's just what you get. And that was in an interview with NBC News Meet the Press with Kristen Welker. Romney said that he was less concerned about the implication of Trump saying he would be a dictator on day one and more concerned about the actions he took toward the end of his presidency when asked about Trump's comments. So I'll let you unpack a little bit about that, John.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a lead into you, but go for it.
That's a lot. But it's Trump, so it's got to be a lot. Well, the remarkable thing about the dictator comment is he was asked about it and asked if he had any plans, if he's reelected, to serve as a dictator or abuse power. Sean Hannity used both those words and phrases. And initially, Trump just sidestepped it. He came back later. Hannity, before the first break on this alleged town hall — a town hall usually involves voters also asking some questions, but Hannity did all the questioning. So right before the first break, Hannity clearly worried about Trump's initial sidestepping and instead of saying, "No, Sean, I'm not going to be a dictator," Trump just didn't really address it. But he didn't say no, did he? He didn't say no. So that made it already pretty big news. And then when Hannity tried to bail him out, Trump even acknowledged that Hannity was worried. He said, "This guy's going crazy." And Trump said on day one, he'll open up more drilling, natural gas and oil drilling, and close the border, whatever that means, and a couple more things on day one. But then on day two, he wouldn't be a dictator anymore. He would just go back to being regular old President Trump. A lot of people disagree with that. A lot of people like me are skeptical that dictators ever give up power easily or peacefully, as I wrote this week. So, once it's kind of like once you embrace the dictator thing, that's you stay there. You don't move off it unless you're forced to. So it was a very troubling comment. People should be worried about you know, what's deep down really in his heart of hearts and what he wants to do and how far he's willing to push the system if he is reelected. And, you know, if the election was held today, there's a good chance he would be reelected. We do almost have about 11 months to go. So it should be troubling. I think it should trouble people that you know, somebody with, especially that personality, he's already showed us what he's capable of. And one troubling thing, and I wrote this in my column for Roll Call this week, is this is just another example of how Trump has desensitized everyone just about, because he says things like this. And then, as you said, he doubles down on it. His defenders in Congress and elsewhere go on television and say, oh, he didn't mean dictator. You know, he was taken out of context.
It'll only be for one day.
Yeah. And they'll defend it and kind of explain it a little bit, or all the media is, you know, attack the media. The media is blowing this out of proportion. And it's just another example of how he uses the media and uses the coverage to really desensitize everyone. And I mean, who couldn't be numb after, what, 8 years of this?
Well, I was numb after a couple of days, Michael.
Yeah. So, of course, being a dictator on day one is, in 24 hours, you can do a lot of damage to a lot of people.
Amen.
So I'm not so sure that I'm comforted by it's only a day one dictatorship. Because right. I heard that sentence that he said, only on day one, and close the border and drill, drill, drill. Now, of course, drill, drill, drill has nothing to do with dictatorship. It's a policy position about oil and gas exploration, I assume. And closing the border...
Either that or he's got a dentist he's not real fond of, but go ahead.
Exactly. That's another point I hadn't thought about. And drill, 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 and close the border are not really responsive to the question. So, you know, I sort of heard it as only on day one, I'll be a dictator, comma. And also, I stand for drilling and closing our borders. So, you know, Hannity didn't parse the grammar of that statement, but you know, a comma there makes a big difference.
Yes, it does.
But the thing about it is, even if he isn't going to be, you know, the next dictator a la Mussolini or Hitler, but rather simply just a strong man like Hungary or Putin or Belarus, it's not good. I think it was Chuck Hagel who, in response to it, the former senator, said something like, what he does that's so bad is he continues to push people into corners and give voice to the polarization that is in our country. That's the real danger, is that there's no ability to find compromise, which is what the democracy system of government, democratic system of government, requires. So even if he's not a dictator in the Hungary Putin sense, if he keeps pushing people into the corners, we become more and more dysfunctional, then he's just, you know, an anti-democrat, not capital D, small anti-democracy person. And that has, you know, terrible long-term implications for the country. So any way you look at it, that's, you know, and when it's combined with his speech where he talks about the real threat is from within, you know, vermin and others, which is, you mm-hmm. know, lines taken out of Hitler's speeches, I think, it just is, it's not good by any stretch. You can't sugarcoat this. And the notion by his apologist speakers that oh, you know, he's just kidding. This always, when he says something outrageous, Stephen Chung, you know, oh, he's just kidding. It's taken out of contest. It's a sad, miserable liberals who are whining about it. It's not acceptable stuff.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, to Michael's point about you can do a lot of damage in one day. If everyone remembers the first day of his first term. After the parade and everything, he went to the Oval Office and they had executive orders ready even back then. And that initial group especially, they weren't exactly veterans of the White House or the administration, but even they had executive orders ready. So just imagine how many executive orders he could sign that evening.
Yeah, in 15, 20 minutes. Look, I'm going to go at it this way. I'm not concerned about Donald Trump saying he'll be a dictator for a day. I lived through 4 years of his attempted dictatorship the last time he was in office. What concerns me are those people. When he last came to office, there were some regular Republicans among those that were appointed. He struck a deal, and so there were some longtime Republicans who made up his first, at least in the beginning, part of his administration. That will not be the case the second time around. These are going to be people that are just loyal to Donald Trump. And I'm less concerned about what Donald Trump will do in day one and what his administration would do with his sycophants for the remaining 4 years of the administration.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Brian, because there's already circulating sort of lists of people who will be cabinet members. And I think there was an interview with, was it Kash Patel? Who has said, essentially we're coming for you. You can look up what he said.
But yeah, he's coming for. Let's see. Yeah.
Right. If season one was the dress rehearsal for season two, it's sort of like season one will be the good old days compared to where we will be because of who will surround him. And as you said, Brian, as we talked about, you can do a lot on day one.
You can do a hell of a lot of damage that you will not be able to undo. And the repercussions, it like ripples in a pond for years and years across this country. And it's not a safe situation and it's very frightening. The other thing that happened, of course, this week was, and this is something that I really kind of, and has shaken some of longtime Democrats. President Biden, when asked in the Roosevelt room initially he said that if it weren't for Donald Trump running, he wouldn't be running. He said but we have to defeat Donald Trump and he's in. But he also said there are 50 other Democrats that could defeat Donald Trump, which I found funny because polls say that right now Biden is not one of them. So is that an indication that he doesn't have the fire in his belly to make this run? I asked the first lady when she made an appearance in L.A. this week, is she supportive of her husband's race for the White House? And she had no answer. That should have been an easy answer to make. So at the same time, I've seen a pressure to get a lot of initiatives done quickly, including the female health initiative that Dr. Jill Biden appeared in L.A. about. They were given a 45-day window at Cedars-Sinai to put together the initiative for the president. It's due December 28th. And they're talking about the Biden train pulling out. These are types of things that I've usually seen in a second administration when a president looks like he's headed for the door, which is frightening and telling. I think there's mixed signals about what's going on with Biden. And John, you're nodding in agreement. You've covered administrations as I have. Does President Biden's statement or any of the actions taken in the office cause for concern?
Well, I think if you're a Democrat, you should be concerned. Because as you said, he's not leading in the polls right now. He's not leading in the right places either. The swing states don't look great right now for Joe Biden, and it's not clear who would run and be the eventual nominee if he decides to not run. It's not at all clear to me that person would be Kamala Harris, the vice president.
I think it's clear that it won't be, but that's it.
A lot of the conventional wisdom is Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, would be a strong contender, and he probably would be a strong contender. But, Biden, I think this also makes Biden look like a weaker candidate. As you said, is his heart really in this? And I don't know how I don't think it's going to affect the fundraising But it was just strange. It was just a strange thing to say. He was also asked as he was leaving the Roosevelt Room if he thought there were other Democrats who could beat Trump. And he said, yeah, about 50 of them.
Yeah.
Well, if that was true.
And why, he's not one of them.
Why did you run again? You told us, months ago that you thought you were the only Democrat who could beat Trump. And now suddenly there are 50 others. So it was a very curious moment. You do have to think about his age at 81 and saying, something like that. It was I think Democrats should be very worried for a number of reasons. This is just one of them.
Michael?
Well, I think without any knowledge or facts that underlie my opinion, which is, as you know, on this show, very normative for me. No facts, but a lot of opinions. I think the thinking of Joe Biden is the same this time around as it was last time around, which is he considers himself the best hope to defeat Donald Trump. And were it not Donald Trump, as he said, if Donald Trump said, look, I've been president once, I don't want to be president again, and I'm not going to run a second term. So he says that as he walks out the door. I think Biden probably doesn't run. I think that he probably holds truer to his view that he was this bridge between what was the first Trump presidency and normalcy, which is where he wants to leave us. But Trump didn't exit stage left. And he's there, and Biden still thinks it's, his continuing mission. What's complicated about it is that coalition that put him in office doesn't seem to be gelling again for him this time. And so while he may have the hope that he will do it again, the numbers on the ground at the moment don't seem positive. The problem here, I think, though, is got another layer to it, which is if President Biden were to step aside, then Kamala Harris is the logical choice among Democrats, because if you're a Gavin Newsom or some other white male, and you know who is the backbone of the Democratic Party, African-American women, how do you run against her? How do you, in a primary setup, run against Kamala Harris, who for sure would run for president, I would assume? The electability of Kamala Harris seems to me less secure than the electability of President Biden. And so, if he were to step aside today, and if my proposition is correct, that it's very hard for a white male to take on a black female in the Democratic primary structure, then are we better off with a somewhat weakened Joe Biden? And it remains to be seen what the Joe Biden of 11 months from now will look like compared to the Joe Biden of now, or a Kamala Harris, who I think is probably even weaker a candidate than Joe Biden. So I think Democrats are in a very difficult situation.
Yeah, I'll go back to something that, the comedian Bill Burr, appearing on Jimmy Kimmel, said America's tired of politics, and that we're tired of two old men being at the top of the ticket. And he said it'd be nice if both of them passed away in their sleep, both Trump and Biden. To which Kimmel said, you're going to get a visit from the Secret Service. He goes, no, I just want them to peacefully pass away. But there is the concern, a growing concern on both sides of the aisle, not so much on the Republican side of the aisle, because those who support Donald Trump don't factor age in to him, even though he is essentially, within two or three years of the same age of Joe Biden. He's in his upper 70s. He's expressed. He's made statements in public that make one concerned about his mental well-being. Of course, he did that when he was in the White House, so I'm not, that's nothing new. But You're right. The Democrats have a problem. And so, you know, I go back to what Bill Burr said, but I'll look at it this way. I was at a comedy club and it was Arsenio Hall who got up, did about 40 minutes, killed when he did. It was a great show, but got up and talked about how both of these guys are too old. And it was Bill Burr who said something very telling, actually. He said, I want someone who's going to be alive to face the repercussions of the decisions that they make. And that's not going to be either one of these fellas. The actuarial tables don't lie. Neither one of them are long for the planet. I mean, they're in their 80s and late 70s. So he was hoping for someone a little younger. And I think that's Americans are just upset with politics in general and upset with aging political leaders. But I don't know if that the political structure being what it is, Michael, you make an excellent point. I don't know that a younger person, more vibrant person is going to be able to step forward. And I do know that there are plenty of people in the Democratic Party who are not fans of Kamala Harris. And while she may be the heir apparent if Joe Biden didn't run, it's not apparent that she would garner enough votes to be get elected. Right, John?
I mean, do you think she's going to get 78 million votes, which is, it looks like that's about what it would take, 79 million votes? I don't think so.
Yeah.
And what is her appeal to independent voters in the Rust Belt or Georgia right now? Her portfolio, I mean, no vice president has a great portfolio. That's kind of the job. You get all the leftover stuff, but
yeah.
I couldn't tell you what her portfolio is, and I get paid to keep an eye on that kind of stuff. So it's a real conundrum right now. You know, there's Andy Beshear. He's the Democratic governor of Kentucky, deep red state Kentucky, and he just won a second term. But I was talking the other night with somebody about this. Would you want to run him against Donald Trump and potentially kind of burn his shot at the White House going against somebody like Trump? Or would it be wiser for the party to keep somebody like that on the shelf, so to speak, for 2028? So it's just not clear what happens if Biden did drop out. There's not much of a campaign there. Brian, you and I have talked about that.
Yeah.
There's not much of a campaign there. He did one event, I believe, after he announced. It's not, I mean, he's fundraising like crazy. He's going to be fundraising again this week. He was fundraising last week. He was in LA and California. So that part of the campaign is very much operational, but Joe Biden hasn't done any campaign rallies. Joe Biden, you know, hasn't done a town hall anytime recently. So, you know, there are signs there like, wait, is this real? Because you can raise funds and then give them to someone else.
Well, and there are Democrats who are really upset that there's not an infrastructure in the swing states for Biden. So, I mean, there are all kinds of warning signs right there in front of us that this is not going well and could end up with Donald Trump back in office. So We're going to take another short break. And when we come back, it's that time of the year. It's Christmas. So we can't get out of, you know, can't get out of this broadcast without talking about Hunter Biden. No, without talking about Christmas music. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and this is our weekend review show, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large CQ Roe Call, an occasional visitor, and I believe you'll be in the pool on Monday, John T. Bennett from Roe Call. Look, we could talk about Hunter Biden. We could talk about a lot of other things, and I just don't care to at this point. So let's talk about, Michael, you brought up something. You had talked about favorite holiday music, rock music. So it's all yours. Take it away, brother Michael.
Well, so I was asked on this show what was my least favorite Bob Dylan song. And I said, you know, the Bob Dylan Christmas album has to be right up there. And so it got me thinking, well, so then that's easy. What's the favorite Christmas song, not Bob Dylan Christmas song, but great favorite Christmas song that you have? And I have two that come to mind. One is not per se a Christmas song. It just has the first lyric that's coming on Christmas, where they're cutting down trees, they're putting up reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace, which is Joni Mitchell's River, which I think is just a brilliant song. And so it's my favorite Christmas song. But in terms of a pure Christmas sort of song, you've got Springsteen's Santa Claus Is Coming to Town. but I'm going to go with a more tried and true Rocking Around the Christmas Tree by Brenda Lee. That's where I'm headed.
John, yours?
I've become a big fan of Run, Run, Rudolph. Run, Run, Rudolph. And all the various covers thereof.
Really? That's...
I didn't expect that. And I had, I guess, the XM channel on. I was doing chores and stuff, and I found myself singing along.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't even know where to go with that. I do like the little drummer boy with, who was it? It was Bowie and Sinatra, or was it Bing Crosby? No, Bowie and Bing Crosby on the show singing Little Drummer Boy, just for the incongruity of those two singing together. It looked like Bing Crosby was a little nervous, and Bowie was just having fun with it. But that's one of mine. But I got to tell you, honestly, there's, and I do want to talk a little bit about this because of the timing of it, but one lyric that I always liked, Very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Let's hope it's a good one without any fear. And I think that's an appropriate lyric for this day and this age. And of course, that's Happy Christmas War is Over with John and Yoko and the Harlem Community Choir actually singing with them. So I'll go with that one for my all time. The one
that's
that
a great, that's a great choice. The one other song that just came to mind as I was listening and thinking, oh man, really Brenda Lee? But
I like Brenda Lee.
Yeah, I do love Nat King Cole's The Christmas Song.
Yeah.
Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. That has to be on a short list. For
yeah,
sure.
That's always on a short list with a nice hot toddy. Hot chocolate sitting around the Christmas tree singing that one.
Did you mention I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas? Also, the Bing Crosby.
That's a good one. Yeah. But the rock and roll version is
we're talking about the rock and roll.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. If you're going strictly rock and roll, I mean, there is something about Bruce Springsteen singing "You Better Watch Out." The rock and beat. To put a backbeat to that is just really enjoyable. But that's
he's got potential, Springsteen. Maybe one of these days he could be Time's Person of the Year.
Hey, I'll tell you this: in 1975, he was on the front cover of Time magazine and Newsweek. I think in the same week, being touted as the future of rock and roll. Maybe it was 1974, but it was right. I think when he made it big right with Born to Run. That was the week he was at. And I remember going, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah. Well, Remember, his first two albums, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, and the next one, were not commercially successful albums.
No.
In 73, he was, you know, still playing tiny clubs here in Washington, the Cellar Door,
yeah.
Child Herald, you know, seating 100-ish people.
Well, the thing I remember about Bruce Springsteen at first was not that he was a singer, but when Manfred Mann's Earth Band came out with Blinded by the Light, he was the right. That was his song.
And yeah, that was, it was.
And he did a version of it, and Manfred Mann killed it with their version. I'm going, who is this Bruce Springsteen guy? That's. But now I know that John, that was a little before your era, I believe, I guess that's, or was
yeah,
it?
I know the boss has a big following, but this will be controversial. The most controversial thing I'll say all day.
A lot of
the songs sound the same. I have a hard time. It's like it's on a loop. So, you know, it's just, you know, personal preference.
So let's say you've panned Springsteen, you've poo-pooed Taylor Swift.
I have.
You've not shown any enthusiasm for Bob Dylan. I'm not sure if you remember who the Beatles are. So, but you're still listening to your AC/DC, Metallica.
Oh yeah.
That's your music, right, John?
That's the good stuff. Yeah, Guns N' Roses. Yeah.
They have a good Christmas album.
I don't know if Guns N' Roses ever did a Christmas album, but they're back together and they're in the money making business. So why not?
Yeah, they're on tour again, John. They're going on
tour? They're touring. They've been touring for a couple years.
The original band?
Most of them, yeah. Once Axl and Slash, I guess, were convinced how much money they could make, they buried their various hatchets.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I could tell you a story about them, but I'll save it for another time. But I will. I'll end this. We're talking about music, and I do want to go back 43 years ago, December 8, 1980. I was working at a pizza place in college, and then I had a late night shift at the local radio station. And there is a guy who, among us that you'd know, John Major Garrett, who was working at the same radio station I was at the time. He's a former White House correspondent. Major and I were in college at the University of Missouri. Halfway through my shift that night, the AP alarm bell went off. Four bells. I had never heard that before. And not having heard that before, we went in to find out that it was about John Lennon, that Lennon had been shot. I immediately called Parkland Hospital. We're in New York, and it was a long night. We played Beatle music all night. That after it was over with, I remember I was going to go to New York and mourn with a lot of friends. I ended up getting very drunk, passing out in my car, woke up with snow falling through the open window on my face. And of course, after that, it was New York and mourning. I've always had a hard time explaining what that particular time in history meant to me. And then Siskel and Ebert showed up on our college campus a year later, talking about some of their favorite movies. And they were talking about The Manchurian Candidate and how it related to the John F. Kennedy assassination. And it was Roger Ebert who said, and I'll never forget it, he said, for his generation, John Kennedy's death meant the end of childhood and the beginning of adulthood. And I knew then that what John Lennon's death was, that was the beginning of adulthood and the end of childhood. It meant a lot to a lot of different people. I mean, here was a guy who was singing, you know, give peace a chance and imagine all the people living in harmony and being gunned down in New York City. So it's always been, you know, and I can't honest to God believe it's been 43 years. And I don't know. I mean, I'll start with you, John, because you are the youngest among us. When you think about that, how does it affect you, if at all?
I just think was an incredibly, sad situation, obviously, very unfortunate. I will plead guilty. I'm not the most knowledgeable John Lennon historian.
Well, I don't think any of us are, but good. Thank you for admitting that. That's Michael?
Well, in my lifetime, I've lived through multiple assassinations. King,
yes.
Both Kennedys, and John Lennon is right up there with, you know, sort of the day the music died for me, and this transition from childhood to adulthood, even though I was, you know, a young adult when he was murdered at, you know, 11 o'clock that evening. But it's just not been the same. Every time I look at the, and it came home, Brian, when they released the Beatles, that is, when the Beatles released this newest song that John was working on. And I'm thinking, oh my God, 1980, he was taken from us. What joy could have been brought to us had he not been shot by Mark David Chapman at 10:50 p.m. December 8th. When I heard it, I was coming out of a pizza place, Million Al's, on 18th Street here in D.C., and I got in the car, and there's Howard Cosell.
There you go. Because
never this occurred.
Monday Night Football.
At the time of a Monday Night Football game, and the person who sort of broke the news was Howard Cosell, who, along with Frank Gifford, were broadcasting the show. And they, you know, sort of broke in to say that John Lennon has been shot outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York.
Walking out of the Dakota. Twice
shot in the back over, you know, a sort of a scribbled signature, I think, right? Wasn't it Mark David Chapman saying that he didn't like the way John Lennon signed his name or something on an album that he had presented to him earlier in the evening?
Well, I think it was earlier he had signed an album for or given him a signature, but there was no sane reason for it. He was he at one point in time believed he was John Lennon, and there was another time, there was an interview where he had gone into a bar and said he just got done interviewing McCartney and Lennon, and they were getting back together. He was with Lennon out of the limelight. I think his madness was able to take reign, and he could pretend to be, you know, John Lennon. And when John came out, and look, there's a couple of things I really, for others who don't understand it, I just started dating my wife, you know, at the time. So Woman, but on that album, Double Fantasy, that just came out a few weeks before he was killed, brought John back into the limelight. All the songs that he produced on that album were stellar. And of course, Paul McCartney's favorite song, John Lennon's song, was on that. It was called Beautiful Boy. The sadness of that is about John with his five-year-old son saying, you know, before you cross the street, take my hand. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. And he talked about holding his son's hand. He goes, I can hardly wait to see you come of age, but I guess we'll both just have to be patient. And those were very poignant, considering that he was to die, you know, shortly thereafter. But there was also other things for anyone who listens to music today, I'll go back to Taylor Swift, the music of hope. There was something about the music back then where they took on political problems. I mean, that was a standard rock trope throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, taking on society. Before it became haters are going to hate, it was Four Dead in Ohio. I mean, they were definitely taking, and that was one of the things that Lennon and the Beatles. You say you want a revolution. Well, we'd all like to change your head. I mean, there were things that rock music took on that John was symbolic of that I think died with him. The day the music died that you refer to, of course, is Buddy Holly. And he was a huge influence. And that was February 3rd of 59. And that was, you know, he was very influential in the Beatles. They all, in fact, Buddy Holly and the Crickets. One of the reasons why the Beatles named themselves the Beatles was after Buddy Holly and the Crickets. They became Beatles, and they were with an A, so it was Beatles and Crickets. So that's, I just think at the end of the day, what we lost 43 years ago has not yet been replaced. And shoes to fill and all that, but that role that was played speaking to injustice and the political oppression and problems. Where do I don't do it, enlighten me if I'm wrong. I just don't see that in the music of today. Anybody?
Irreplaceable, even by Taylor Swift.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad that she's made a lot of money, and I'm glad that she's a storyteller. But you know, there were others before that, and Lennon was one of them for me. So with that,
you know, I've told you, Brian, I've told you on this podcast before, and I think I'll say it again, that all you need to know is the lyrics of the Beatles and Bob Dylan's songs, and nothing else can be additive.
Well, of course, Guns N' Roses, but that's right, John?
Oh, maybe not. I wouldn't even go that far.
So as we bring the show to a close, I guess we could talk about Hunter Biden's 9 charges. Anybody want to chime in on that one? If he's guilty, let him go. That's John.
Well, no, actually,
I mean, if he's guilty, prosecute him. That's let it fly.
Yeah, I think that's right. It appears that some laws may have been broken here, and he should not be immune or get a lesser punishment just because his father happens to be the president right now. And when you're in the limelight, you get more scrutiny, and
unless you're Jared.
Well, there is that. That is the counter argument you hear from Democrats, that Jared Kushner, as soon as he walked out of his White House job, got a couple billion dollars from the investment fund. But you know, Hunter didn't do things. He didn't register, you know, as a foreign, whatever the term is there, foreign agent, I guess, or not foreign agent, but he didn't take the proper steps while doing business overseas. Didn't pay his taxes, etc. So yeah, if he's guilty, he should be prosecuted and should have the same punishment that you or I would have.
Exactly.
This is political. There's a big political dynamic. Republicans are working hard to make the possible crimes of the son the crimes of the father, and that's not a criminal matter. That's a political matter. You know, they're gonna. Looks like hold Hunter Biden in contempt of Congress later this week. He's been subpoenaed in the House impeachment inquiry to testify. Hunter Biden and his legal team tried to call House Republicans bluff by saying, okay, he'll come, but only in a public hearing. And even this morning, some of the committee members were on the Sunday shows, and they want to do a closed-door deposition. We've of course seen House Republicans leave these depositions and say X happened, and later that day release the transcript and there was no X. Misled everyone. They just didn't tell the truth about what was said behind closed doors. And understandably, Hunter Biden and his lawyer Abby Lowell want to avoid that, and I think we can all understand why, because then on Fox News and conservative media, the correct version of the transcript is not always reported, is it?
No.
Facts
don't matter.
Play out. Yeah, the political part will continue to play out, just as it is now, really. But this is a problem. This is another problem for Joe Biden. Hunter is officially a political liability. He was before, but these new charges. And the fact that now, you know, Congress is going to is just going to keep beating this drum, you know, other than the farm bill and something next year to keep the government open beyond the election. It's not going to be a big legislative year. It's an election year. It never is, really. And the defense policy bill. So House Republicans will have to do something. And I how many hearings on Hunter Biden could they hold? The three committees have jurisdiction, judiciary, oversight, and ways and means because of the tax piece. So they can make this a big issue, an even bigger issue next year.
Michael, is it disconcerting at all that Jim Jordan isn't facing any repercussions for not answering a congressional subpoena, and they're going to hold Hunter Biden in contempt?
Well, that would speak to whether or not there's any hypocrisy on Capitol Hill. And I've seen no evidence of it so far in the last 5 minutes. So it's hard to answer that. It's hard to answer that question. But, you know, look, if I don't know whether there's anything to whether or not President Biden benefited from his son's gross influence peddling and whether or not Joe Biden has been truthful with the American public or not. I don't know the evidence at all. But Hunter Biden did profit from his father's name. He did fail to pay taxes. In the indictment, he's charged with having earned $7 million from essentially foreign consulting gigs and failed to pay taxes on $1.4 million, having failed to report income and having taken deductions for things that he called business-related expenses, which would be legitimate, but which in fact turned out to be anything but business-related, unless you're a pimp. And I don't think that Hunter Biden is being prosecuted because he's Hunter Biden. I think he's being prosecuted because he engaged in a scheme of bad behavior that most people, especially people who they call politically exposed persons, people who are public figures or related to public figures, who get a higher level of scrutiny globally, would face. As to if I'm a Republican and I'm conducting an investigation, or put it this way, if I'm a congressperson and I'm conducting an investigation, absolutely I would like my witnesses to be behind closed doors. Ask Adam Schiff about how he conducted the first Trump-Ukraine impeachment. It was all behind closed doors, and he said it was necessary to preserve the integrity of the investigation. And so if now the Republicans are saying the same thing, why, if it was legitimate for Schiff, and I'm not sure it was, but if it was legitimate for Schiff, is it not legitimate for Comer and his investigative team? So it's, you know, the end of Casablanca or the middle of Casablanca of gambling is going on here, and I'm shocked. Hypocrisy is going on here, and I'm shocked.
You know? Well, look, if he has been indicted, he needs to face the charges. Everyone is accountable under the law. So, and you know, some people aren't more equal than others. And you're right about Adam Schiff, and you're right about all of that. At the end of the day, he should be prosecuted. He should face whatever justice he has to face, and we move on. As far as the politics of it, I'm shocked that there's politics involved in it. I'm just shocked, mind you, just shocked beyond belief that there would be any political wrangling involved in any of this. But that being said, I also think that after 3 years, the what we've seen so far, and we don't know, all right, we don't know, but there has been no evidence that we've seen so far from Comer that would link the president to any actions with his son that could lead to, of course, you know, an indictment of the president or the political expedient idea of, you know, impeaching him. I haven't seen any of that yet. But if it exists, go for it. But at the same time, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So that's how I'll end that. Prosecute if you want. And a happy Festivus for the rest of us. John, I'll let you plug. Where can we see you, brother?
Going to be a busy week. Congress is trying to leave town. House on Thursday. The Senate, at least saying they're going to be in Friday. So they have a lot to do. And you can follow us at rollcall.com as we cover them trying to leave. They'll probably leave in a huff, as they always do around this time.
Under the cover of night, under the cloak of darkness, on the last train out. That's
going to be some week. It's going to be a big.
Michael,
the sad part is that they come back.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very fond of the
they're like
the
swallows at Capistrano.
I'm very fond of the band Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks Band. And for those who aren't familiar with it, go Google it or Spotify it. But Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks Band has a song which is entitled, "How Can I Miss You When You Won't Go Away?"
Boy, that's and, wow. So, Michael, where can we catch up with you? Your turn.
So my podcast is called That Said with Michael Zeldin. It appears on all of the major podcast outlets. I would be very welcoming of people who wanted to help me to give me ratings or other such things. But it is a book-based podcast. We talk to authors about interesting topics. And in fact, I think next year I've got lined up Sanjay Gupta, Brian Stelter, the people who wrote a book, which I think is very compelling in this conversation that we've just had about the First Amendment and college campuses, called The Canceling of the American Mind. A good, interesting read. It's a follow-on from their earlier book, The Coddling of the American Mind. And it talks about diversity, equity, and inclusion and the impact it is having on college campuses and woke and canceling stuff. So there's a lot of interesting things to think about in these hour-long interviews that I present. So come on, give me a rating and help me out here.
You got it. And I got one for you. The name of this podcast is called Just Ask the Question. And we want to thank all of our listeners and viewers for making us one of the top 30 podcasts on Good Pods. The name of the book is called Free the Press. You can find it wherever fine books are sold. And of course, weeklyinsalon.com with a column. And you can catch me asking questions whenever I get a shot in front of the president or the first lady or anybody else in this administration. So once again, thanks for joining us. The name of the podcast is called Just Ask the Question. And I am your host, Brian Karam. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time. And everybody, please have a happy holiday, a happy and safe holiday season.
NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.